Keep Thee in All Thy Ways, an anthology of supernatural stories by O'Sell, read by Baylor, rated R. Jonah of Dalhart, a coda to episode 416, On the Head of a Pin. The first time Dean woke up, his vision was unfocused. He saw a blue wall or a blue ceiling, and he was aware of that, and of forced air moving in and out of his lungs, and of the faint itch of the strap that held the tube in his mouth. The second time he was sedated, and he couldn't move, and he was seeing things, or hoped he was seeing things. The third time he saw Sam, and Sam bent over him and said that he told the police Dean had been mugged, so if anyone asked, that's what he should say, or probably just say he didn't remember anything. He lay there and stared mutely at Sam, and thought that Sam touched his face or his head, and then he was out again. He finally woke up for real, and a day later they came to take out the ventilator tube. The nurse braced her hand against his chest, and the doctor told him to breathe out hard, and the tube scraped his throat when it came up, and hardly looked big enough to warrant all the gagging, and the nurse wiping his chin, and Sam bringing him water from the bathroom. He didn't think it had hurt as much the last time, but that had been a long time ago, and things had been different then. He had been different. He didn't know where Sam was when Castiel came to talk to him, and by the time Sam came back, Castiel was gone, and Dean had dried his face and gotten himself together, and he didn't say anything about it to Sam. The next afternoon, they released him with a bag of pill bottles and a pamphlet on head injuries and a card for a follow-up appointment that he was never going to keep, and Sam drove them back to the motel where he'd been staying. Dean sat on one bed, and Sam sat on the other with his back against the headboard and his shoes on, and he picked up the remote and started surfing channels, and Dean said, "Sam, you don't have to stay." Sam glanced at him. "What are you talking about?" "You got something to do. Go do it." "What do I have to do?" "You want to see Ruby. Go see Ruby." "I don't need to see Ruby." "You didn't find me on your own, and you didn't..." He stopped and cleared his throat. He was still hoarse, and his throat and jaws ached. "I know about Alistair and what you did. You saw her. You've seen her. So just... you don't have to lie to me about it." "Dean..." Dean flapped a hand at him. "Look, Sam, I'm just going to dope up and hit the sack. So just go if you gotta go." "I'm not going anywhere," Sam said, and turned back to the television. Dean got up and crossed to the bathroom. His head hurt fiercely, and he had to walk slowly, and he knew that Sam was watching him. He went into the bathroom and shut the door and dumped a bottle out of the pharmacy bag, and his hands were shaking and the pills were rattling, and he knew Sam could hear it. He muttered fucks to himself and stuck his hands under his armpits and stood there and tried again. This time he got the lid off, and he took two pills and drank a glass of water and used the toilet and went back out to the bedroom. Sam was still sitting there like he was going to sit there. Dean stripped down to his underwear and climbed under the covers and turned over, and the splitting misery in his head receded like an echo, and he fell asleep. When he woke, it was dark, and the television was off. He said, "Sam?" and no one answered. He turned onto his back and lay there in a drifting nausea and listened to the tidal whisper of traffic on the interstate. Footsteps creaked across the ceiling above him. The television muttered in the next room. He raised up on his elbows and reached over and turned on the light and looked around the room. The curtains were drawn, and it was past 9 o'clock, and Sam was gone. He got up slow and got dressed slow. He had to sit down to pull on his jeans because his balance was off. They said that would go away. Sam had taken Dean's bag out of the car, and it was there on the floor, still zipped closed, and he picked it up and shouldered it. He went into the bathroom and stuffed a couple of the pill bottles into his pocket and turned off the light and left. He thought no one in their right mind would pick up someone who looked like him, but then a Ryder truck slowed down with its signal on and stopped a few feet ahead of him, and he walked up to it and opened the door and climbed in and pulled the door shut. The driver put the truck in gear and merged back into the traffic. "How far are you going?" They were on the northbound lane, and Dean sat however far north he wanted to take him, and the driver said that would be Dalhart, and Dean said that was fine. "Can you give me something for the gas?" "Yeah." "Okay." It was raining now, and the driver turned on the wipers, and Dean could see the man looking at him from the corner of his eye, and knew what he was going to say even before he said, "What's the other guy look like?" Dean sat there and thought about it. Then he just said, "I don't know." The driver didn't say anything to that. After a while, he said, "It's colder than a witch's tit. First day of spring, my ass. So much for that global warming, huh?" "Yeah. This time of year, it always feels like it's never going to get warm out. Then before you know it, you're bitching about the heat. Happens every year." The red taillight streaked across the asphalt and refracted onto the smeared glass, and the tires of the big trucks churned up a smoking mist, and the wipers beat and squealed on the windshield. "Maybe not this year," Dean said. "How's that?" "Nothing," Dean said, and he turned his head and closed his eyes. "So what's the other guy look like?" she said, and Dean had to smile at her, even though his face hurt as if the bones in it had all been knocked about a quarter of an inch out of place. "Let me guess," she said. "That's the 200th time you've heard that question so far." 199th. "Well, I have a hard time coming up with original material at this time of night." She looked at the clock over the counter. "Make that morning. You want to eat something, or are you just coming in out of the rain?" "No, no," Dean said. He picked up the plastic menu. "I'll order something." "You don't have to," she said. She had a plain and pointed face, and pale skin and light eyes the color of polar ice. She leaned over and said, "You just want to sit here and drink coffee for 2 hours, that's fine. It ain't like we're going to get a run or nothing." "I could go for a cup of coffee," he said. "Why don't you get one for yourself, too?" "I'm not really supposed to." "Who's going to know?" "The cook's an asshole." "Fuck him." He threw a few 20s on the table. "Split the tip with him." She looked back toward the kitchen, and her ponytail slipped over her shoulder, and then she looked at Dean and said, "All right." He took 2 pills while she was gone, and she came back and put thick china mugs of coffee down on the table and sat down across from him. "What are you taking?" "What?" "What prescription?" "Oh, just..." He gestured at his face. "Something for this." "Percocet?" "Percocet's good. I was in a car accident a few years ago, and that was like the magic bullet." "Pretty much." "What's your name?" "Dean." "Oh, I like that. I've always liked that name. Sounds like the name of someone who knows what he's doing." "I don't know what I'm doing." "Generally speaking, or just now?" "Both." She tapped a nail on her mug and said, "My name's Amy." "Okay, Amy." His eyes dropped from her waish face down to her open collar. She was wearing a silver cross around her neck. "That's pretty," he said. "Oh," she said. She hooked her thumb under the chain and zipped the cross around on the end of it. "Thanks. I've had it forever. Are you a Christian?" Dean looked out the window and shook his head and bit his lip and then looked back at Amy. I believe in angels." "So do I," she said. "I believe that God assigns us an angel to watch out for every one of us, no matter who we are. Rich or poor, famous or nobody, black, white, whatever. When I was little, I thought I could see mine." "What did he look like?" "She. It was a she, and she was beautiful, like you'd expect an angel to be. All white and golden, and she had beautiful long hair and wings, and..." She stopped and stared at him. "Are you laughing at me?" "No," he said. He put his hand over his heart. "I swear to God, Amy, I'm not laughing at you." She grinned and said, "Yes, you are. You're laughing at me." "Well, you go ahead and laugh, mister, 'cause she was my angel, and she was beautiful, and she took care of me, and you're just jealous." "Yeah, I am," he said. "I wish I knew more angels like that." "Why? What are your angels like?" He sat there and looked at Amy. Outside, a car drove into the parking lot and splashed through a U-turn and drove back out. There was no music or radio playing in the place, and all he could hear was the cook banging away at the grill as if an army of customers was piled up for hash browns and grits and bacon. He thought about Uriel and Anna and of Castiel sitting in his hospital room with his tragic face and his wrinkled overcoat, saying things whose meaning he himself didn't know. How weak they were for all their bluster and threats, and how scared and uncertain and imperfect. "They're a lot like me," he said. "Well," she said with a smile, "you're not so bad." He drank his coffee, and Amy stirred hers and balanced the spoon on its end and twirled it one way and the next. She looked out the window for a while. There were no cars in the parking lot, and it was still raining, and there were no cars on the access road going past the diner, and in the distance the sodium arcs loomed over the empty on-ramp and the quiet interstate. "How'd you get here?" "A guy dropped me off." "You're never going to get another ride tonight." "Looks that way." "Where are you trying to get to?" "Some place that's not where I left." She nodded. "You got any place to go tonight?" "I figured I'd sit here till it stopped raining, try to get another ride, go up into Dalhart and get on a bus or something." "You got any place to sleep?" He shrugged and made a vague gesture at the diner, and she put the spoon down on the napkin and reached across the table and touched his hand. "My shift is over in 15 minutes. I think you should come home with me." "I don't think that's a good idea, Amy." She leaned in toward him and said coyly, "Why not?" He was starting to feel detached and cloudy from the pills, and he bent forward and whispered, "Because I've got angels watching over me." She smiled. "Well, hell, Dean. Might as well give them something to look at." Amy disappeared in the back and came back wearing a purple corduroy jacket and a brown bucket of a pocketbook, and they went outside and ran through the rain and got in her car and sat in the parking lot while the rain hissed on the roof. They drank schnapps from a bottle she mined up out of her purse and smoked a joint, and after a while they started messily kissing, and he was halfway on top of her when she pushed him off and said, "I don't want to do this here." "Why not?" "'Cause I ain't 14, that's why. Let's go home." "Sure." She crawled through the dark, wet streets, leaning forward until her chin was almost on top of the steering wheel and squinting through the windshield while the wipers whacked back and forth. "These wipers are making me dizzy," she said. "I hate driving in the rain." Dean was almost asleep when they pulled into the driveway of a sagging clapboard house on a lightless street. Strange plastic shapes littered the front yard, and Dean stumbled over one of them and went sprawling into the porch post, and Amy laughed and grabbed his hand and pulled him up the stairs. The house was dark and not warm and had a burnt and greasy smell. A middle-aged woman was asleep under an afghan on the couch, and the television droned low and washed the room in blue light. "That's my mom," Amy whispered. "She always sleeps down here. TV helps her sleep." "Your mom?" "Relax, sugar. I'm street legal." They crept past the couch through the living room. To the left, a pink nightlight burned in the kitchen. Amy started up a dark and squeaky flight of stairs, and Dean could feel a slide of threadbare carpet beneath his boots. The stairs were too narrow for them to go up side by side, so she took him by the elbow and led the way up the stairs, and then blindly down a black hallway to a room where she closed the door and clicked on the lamp beside the bed and turned to him. She took off her jacket and let it fall on the floor, and he did the same thing, and then they were kissing again. Drunk, wet, sloppy. She pushed up his shirt and pulled it over his head, and she ran her hands up his arms, and then she pulled back and said, "What's that?" He glanced down at the burn on his shoulder and said, "My guardian angel." "Huh?" "Forget it," he said, and plucked her hands off the scar and put his hands on her face and walked her back toward the wall until her knees hit it and she fell onto the mattress. She scooted herself back on her elbows and she unbuttoned her jeans, and he shucked her out of them and she did the same to him, and then she was under him, warm and smooth and naked and smelling like schnapps and smoke and fruity hairspray. He thought she might be expecting a wild ride that he wasn't in any condition to provide, but she was quiet and soft and gentle in bed, and when they were finished, she crossed her legs around him and stroked his back while he lay there with his face against the damp crook of her shoulder, and she ran her fingers through his hair. "Still raining out," she said. "You gonna stay? You want me to go?" "No, stay here. I'll make waffles for breakfast. Okay. He rolled off her and onto his side, and she curled up behind him and laid her arm across his waist, and he closed his eyes and listened to the rain on the window. He was too drunk and drugged to dream about anything, and a child's voice woke him from a black and soundless sleep. What is it, baby? I had a bad dream. Go get your grandma, honey. No, I want to sleep in my bed. He felt Amy roll over in bed and heard her sigh. Okay, honey, go on in your room. I'll be there in a minute. Okay. Dean lay without moving and gave silent thanks to somebody that the kid hadn't toddled in while he was banging her mother. Amy caressed his shoulder once, and then she got up and the mattress sprung back from her weight, and he heard her getting dressed, and she left and closed the door behind her. When he woke, it was barely dawn. He sat up in the bed and looked around the room. He hadn't paid any notice to it before, and now he saw that it was just big enough for the bed and a dresser, and on the dresser were framed pictures of children, a little girl and a bald baby. He put his hand to his head and he sat there. When the vertigo passed, he got up and he picked his clothes up off the floor and got dressed, and he opened the door and stepped out into the hallway. It was very quiet. The old walk of shame, he thought. He passed a room where there were two lumpy shapes in the bed and a child's foot sticking out from under the covers and SpongeBob curtains over the window, and he made it to the bathroom at the end of the hall. He took a piss and washed his face and drank cold water out of his hands and stared at himself in the mirror. He stepped out of the bathroom, drying his face on his shirt tail, and heard a froggy noise off to his right, and he looked that way and saw the bald baby standing up in a crib with what looked like a full diaper dragging down the seat of its blanket sleeper. The baby stared at Dean and gummed the crib rail, and then scrunched up its face and started to whimper. "Hey," he said from the doorway. "Shh." He glanced into the other bedroom, but no one in there was close to awake, and he went back to the baby's room. The baby's face was turning red, and the room stank of baby shit, and the baby jumped up and down. "Okay, okay," Dean whispered. "Stop bellyaching." He flipped the baby onto its back and stripped off the blanket sleeper and the diaper, and the smell of it made his throbbing head pitch. He hadn't changed a diaper since he was 7 years old, and he hadn't missed it. "Jesus," he said, "you stink. You stink worse than Sam stunk." He went back into the bathroom and tossed the mess into the wastebasket and fumbled around in the early half-light until he found a box of diapers, and he cleaned off the baby with a wad of toilet paper and slapped the diaper onto him and zipped him back up in his sleeper, and the baby rolled over and pulled itself up on the crib rail. Dean bent down to the baby's eye level. "How's that, shitty pants?" he asked, but the baby was gaping wide-eyed at something over Dean's shoulder, and Dean froze where he was and felt the hair stand up on the back of his neck. "Cass?" "Yes." Dean closed his eyes. "What are you doing here?" "What are you doing here?" Dean looked over his shoulder, and Castiel said, "Did having sex with that woman make you feel better?" "It didn't make me feel worse." "You don't look better." "Thanks," he said. He straightened up and turned to Castiel. "What are you doing here?" "Your brother is looking for you." "Is he?" "He will be looking for you." Dean grinned. "You know what I love about you, Cass? That pathological honesty. It must be really fucking inconvenient, never being able to lie." "Why would it be inconvenient?" Dean stared at him and then shook his head. "Never mind." "You can't stay here." "I wasn't planning on moving in." "Dean," the angel said, "you have to go back." "Back where? To what?" "You know what you have to do." Dean smiled tightly and turned away. He didn't want to look at Castiel, so he looked out the window and saw a yard with three trash cans and a tangle of weeds taking shape in the milky light, and the rooftops of small, shabby houses like this one, and above it all a gray sky that bore the sureness of rain. He said, "See, Cass, that's just the thing. I don't." He looked back at Castiel. "And neither do you. And that scares the shit out of me." "You have to end it, Dean." "Oh, come on," he hissed. "You don't know what that means, and I don't know what that means, so how the fuck am I supposed to do it? You get any fucking memos from the boss since the last time I saw you? Because you were sure as hell out of ideas then. Behind him, the baby started to whimper, and Castiel said nothing, and Dean smirked and said, Yeah, that's what I thought. Castiel blinked and stared at Dean, and then he said, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, too. Sorry you got the wrong guy. I'm sorry I didn't come for you. Before I could break your seals and kick off this whole fuck-up? No, Castiel said. I'm sorry I didn't come for you. For you. Dean stood there and looked at the angel, and Castiel said, I wish now I had come for you before I was told to. I wish you hadn't suffered for so long. I wish I had known. I am sorry. Dean cleared his throat. Well, shit, Cass, he said, and the baby suddenly let out a sharp and startling wail, and Castiel reached out and touched the baby's forehead, and the baby crumpled down silently onto the mattress. Dean looked at the baby. He looked at the angel. Did you just zap that baby? He said. Did you just fucking zap that baby? He turned and bent over the crib rail and felt the baby's pulse. You're a real dick, Cash, you know that? A real? Then the angel's arms were around him in a tight embrace, and Castiel's head was on his back. Dean said, Castiel? Yes? What are you doing? I'm comforting you. Dean stood there with his arms hanging over the crib rail. He closed his eyes and sighed. No offense, but this is more like getting groped in the john. What? Dean stood up and shook Castiel off, and Castiel took a step back, and Dean turned to him. Okay, Cass, he said, you're a guy. I'm not a guy. Well, you're... He gestured at Castiel. You're wearing a guy, all right? And there's ways guys do these things and ways they don't. Castiel stared at him with his head in a tilt and a blank look on his face, and Dean heard Amy talking about her golden angels, and he felt like laughing or crying, or maybe doing both at the same time. You want to give a little show of support to a guy? You don't grab him from behind like a child molester, okay? What do you do? Dean rubbed his face and looked at Castiel. Okay, come here, he said. He held out his arms and gestured to Castiel, and Castiel stepped into the arc of Dean's arms and stood there. All right, you can. Dean put his arms around Castiel and slapped him on the back and then pulled away. You can do that. That's good. All right. And if something heavy is going on, you can do it twice, Dean said. He put his arms around Castiel and clapped him twice on the back. The angel felt small and slight in Dean's arms. Fragile. Dean stepped away and said, Got it? I think so. Okay, Dean said. Let me try it. Okay. Castiel stepped up and put his arms around Dean and clumsily smacked him on the back, and Dean coughed, and then Castiel clapped him twice between his shoulder blades as if he were burping a baby. Dean winced and said, That's better, and began to draw back, and then Castiel grabbed Dean's shirt in his hands. He locked his arms around Dean and held on to him, and Dean went still and did not push him away. I won't leave you, Castiel said. Do you understand? Castiel didn't move. Dean stood there. He shall give his angels charge over thee to keep thee in all thy ways, Castiel said. And Dean laughed and tried to pull away, and Castiel wouldn't let him, and he wasn't fragile at all. At all. In all thy ways, Dean. I'll follow you to hell if it comes to that. Cass, you can't run. I know you want to, but you can't. I wasn't running. What were you doing? I don't know. I don't know. You've never run from anything. I know that now. That's why it has to be you. This isn't like anything else. It's different. No, it isn't. Your whole life has brought you here. You and your brother. My brother will fail if you leave him, is failing, will take the world with him. Dean closed his eyes. After a while, he put his arms around Castiel and laid his face against his shoulder. I don't know how to save him. Stay with him. He doesn't need me. He needs you more than he ever has, so do all of us need you. It's not going to work. Whatever you want me to do, it's not going to work. Yet still, you must do it. Dean pressed his forehead into Castiel's shoulder. He crossed his arms against Castiel's back. Then he said, "Oh my God." "Yes," Castiel said. He put his hand on the back of Dean's head. "Yes." Amy woke and sat up in the bed. She had dreamt of angels, though not of any angels that she had ever read about or seen pictures of or believed in. These angels had been weary and ancient and had filled her with an aching sadness that seemed to come from somewhere beyond the edges of the world. She sat there and clasped her hands, but none of her simple Sunday school prayers came to her lips, because in this place and this time and to those dolorous beings in her dream, they all meant nothing. She looked at her daughter and saw that she was still asleep, and then got out of bed very troubled, and first looked next door and saw that the man she'd brought home wasn't there, and then she went into the baby's room. The baby was curled up and sleeping peacefully and smiling, and the room had a faint odor in it of lilies or roses. She stood over the baby's crib and put her hand on his back, and after a while she was crying, though she didn't know why. And outside, the first drops of rain struck the window, and the sky was dark and clouded, and lay heavy over the land. Thou shalt not be afraid for the terror by night, nor for the arrow that flieth by day, nor for the pestilence that walketh in darkness, nor for the destruction that wasteth at noonday. For he shall give his angels charge over thee, to keep thee in all thy ways. Psalm 91. Once, set in the future, portrayed in episode 5-4, The End. Thank you. To these people, he was just Cass, had never been anything but Cass, and because it had been years since names mattered, not even the girls ever asked him if it was short for something or what his last name was. Among all of them, only Dean knew his real name, Castiel, the name he was given in heaven so long ago that he didn't recall anything of his own beginning at all, the name he carried down to hell when he was sent to bring Dean up, although he didn't know then who Dean was or anything about him, nor had he cared to know. His name when he disobeyed and apostatized and threw in his lot with that same Dean. And Castiel, what the last of the angels called him when they said they were forsaking this world, and there would be no coming back for him if he didn't go with them, and he said no. And they went away sorrowful and not understanding, and they did not return. Since then he had just been Cass, except to Dean, and even then only sometimes now, as if he also had forgotten. A girl named Lori had been sitting up with him in the camp's kitchen, but the cabin was cold and damp and drafty, and Cass wouldn't let her light the stove because their supplies were so low. She stood up and wrapped her sweater tight around herself and stepped over the picnic table's bench and looked down at him. "Come to bed," she said. Cass smiled and shook his head. "You gonna sit here all night? You don't know when they'll be back." "It's okay," he said. "You should have gone with them if you're so hung up on it." "They didn't ask." "Maybe if you weren't stoned all the time." "Maybe." He gestured to the candle on the table. "Take the candle so you don't fall. It's raining. You could put your hand over it." "I can find my way. Besides, what are you going to do? Sit here in the dark?" "Probably." She sighed and walked away. At the cabin's door, she turned. "I don't get you at all, Cass. Sometimes you're so sweet, and then other times you're just... I don't know. You're not the only one who's been through shit, you know." "My child," he said, "of all the shit in creation, who can say that your shit is the equal of my shit, or mine the equal of yours, or whose shit is the greater or lesser shit, and that worse shit is not yet to come, which indeed it is, and in fact has yet even to hit the fan." She stared at him. "What the fuck does that mean?" He smiled. "Good night, Lori." "Whatever," she said, and banged the door shut behind her. He heard her footsteps slosh off across the camp's sodded mud, and then the squeak and slam of her cabin's door, and then it was quiet. Chill autumn rain tapped on the roof. It fell into the collection barrels beside the kitchen's back porch. Shadows crowded around the candle stump on the table. This was an awful place. In their last camp, they'd had electricity and running water, but their survival depended upon mobility, and they stayed there too long and lost so much in the escape. If the party that Dean had let out that afternoon came back with nothing or not enough, they wouldn't be able to stay here for long. He reached into his pocket and pulled out a wrap and the last shreds of weed and rolled himself a joint and licked it and sealed it and lit it off the candle, and he took a long drag and held it and then blew out the smoke and the candle at the same time. He sat in the dark and smoked. His foot ached the way it always did when it rained or was cold. It had never really healed. He'd lain in bed for more than a week after he'd broken it, horrified by the pain and his inability to heal himself, and more than anything by the understanding that to be human was to be so broken with no assurance of help or protection against something worse. He had thought he would go insane from that new and appalling knowledge. He would at the least have become wholly crippled if Dean hadn't finally hauled him up out of bed and dragged him around the room, not saying a word while Cass cried and cursed until he realized that Dean had been through this endless cycle of pain and recovery and pain again, and so much worse than this, and yet here he was, bereft of both God and hope and beset by demons. Here they all were. He'd shut up and gone around the room with Dean, and the next day he'd woken up and found a battered pair of crutches leaning against the bed, and he'd understood and had gotten up on his own. That had been a long time ago. Dean was different now, and he had become Cass, just Cass, the one with the limp and the weed habit, and a suspicion that Dean was the only reason most of the others even tolerated him, though he was as useless to Dean as he was to the rest of them. It made him sick of himself to be like this, and bitter and sarcastic and dissolute, and there were times he thought about leaving, but he couldn't. The rain dripped into the barrels, and the coal end of the joint waxed and waned, and Cass, Castiel once, sat there in the cold and dirty darkness of that room and thought of what a terrible affliction this humanity was. The headlights woke him, and he raised his head from the picnic table and sat there blinking. The truck doors slammed, and he heard their voices and their tread on the steps, and they seemed heavier than usual, and something not right about them. And then the door was kicked open, and their misshapen silhouettes were black against the white glare of the headlights. He shaded his eyes and tried to see. "Get a light," someone said. He thought it was Frank. They were across the room and hauling something up onto the table, and the candle and candle holder skittered off and clattered to the floor, and Cass looked down and saw Dean on the table, staring up at the ceiling, wide-eyed and as pale as a lamp in that gloom. "Get a fucking light, Cass." Cass tripped over the bench and stumbled across the room, and he got the LED lantern off of the floor and came back with it and switched it on, and someone killed the headlights. Frank grabbed the lantern and held it up and bent over, and Dean pushed himself up on his elbows. "Get it out," Dean said. "Get it out." "That's the plan," Frank said. Dean dropped his head back between his shoulder blades. "Fuck. Motherfucking kids. I never even saw the little shit. I think he was up in the warehouse." "Fuck," Dean said. And then Tricia was there with the scissors, and she started cutting away the material from Dean's left leg. "Hold this," Frank said, and gave Cass the lantern, and Frank leaned over and helped Tricia expose Dean's leg and the arrow sticking out of it, the shaft some half inch in diameter, and the fletchings made from dissected shuttlecocks, and the head buried down into Dean's thigh. His leg was already swollen and blackening, but the wound was plugged by the arrow shaft, and there was not much blood. "Dean," Cass said, and Dean looked at him but didn't answer. Frank and Tricia rolled him over onto his side, and Dean grabbed the edge of the table and lay there with his jaw clenched. The other side of his leg was also bruised and swollen, but the skin wasn't broken. "How bad?" Frank shook his head. "Not even the point. We're going to have to push it through." "Shit," Dean said. "Okay, just get the fucking thing out." Chuck was at Cass's elbow, and Frank told him to get the morphine, and Chuck was halfway to the door when Dean said, "Wait, wait, what do we have?" Chuck looked at Frank, and Frank mouthed something, and Dean repeated, "What do we have?" "4. "Oh, you fucking asshole," Frank said. Dean ignored him and told Chuck, "Fuck the morphine. Go get me some of Ted's hooch, if there's any of that. I'm not ripping a goddamn arrow out of your leg on nothing but Ted's hooch." Tricia said, "For Christ's sake, just take it, Dean." Dean craned his neck around and looked at his leg. There was a rim of blood seeping around the arrow shaft now, little bubbles in it like liquid escaping from a capped bottle. He felt the back of his leg. He put his head down on the table and closed his eyes. 1. Chuck said, "It's pretty old stuff. One's barely going to take the edge off." 1, Dean said. He lay there with his eyes closed. He was shivering, and Tricia took off her jacket and threw it over his shoulders and went to start a fire in the stove. Frank was washing his hands in a pan of water. Cass set the lantern on the table. He took off his sweater and folded it and put it under Dean's head and sat down on the bench. He looked at the entry wound and put out his hand and barely touched it with his fingertips, and Dean shuddered. "I'm sorry," Cass said. "I'm sorry." Dean didn't say anything. "Once," Cass said softly, "I could have healed this with a touch." When he looked at Dean's face, Dean's eyes were half open. "I'd settle for a zap to the head. Knock me out for a few hours." He grimaced. "Nothing left, is there?" "No," Cass said. "There's nothing left." Chuck gave him one shot of morphine, and they waited about 5 minutes, and then Dean nodded. "Do it." They held him down. Chuck, Tricia, and Cass. Frank leaned on his leg and wrapped his hand around the arrow's tail. He took a deep breath and repositioned his hand and looked at the others and at Dean, and he closed his eyes for a second and said something to himself, and then shoved the arrow down into Dean's leg. Dean seized up and grabbed the table. His jaw was trembling. The arrowhead wasn't out. "Son of a bitch," Frank said. Dean rolled his eyes up to him. "I think it's against the bone," he said, and Dean squeezed his eyes shut. "Give him another shot," Frank said to Chuck, and Dean shook his head. "No." "Just fucking do it, Chuck. That puts us down to 2. You want to go into shock? Try it one more time." "You sure?" "Yeah," Dean said. He braced himself against the edge of the table. Frank wiped the back of his hand across his forehead, and he bent over Dean's leg, and the others held Dean in place, and Frank pushed the arrow hard, and it shoved in about 1/2 inch, and it still didn't come out, and Dean bellowed and slammed his forehead against the table. They stood there in the cold wash of lantern light. No one spoke. Now others had come, and they stood just inside the cabin door, and they were quiet, too, and tense and frightened, and the only sounds were the flames in the stove and Dean's labored breathing. "I can try to cut it out," Frank said. Tricia said, "You'll have to carve through 1/2 his leg. He'll lose a lot of blood." "Fuck. Fucking rock in a hard place." From the table, Dean said, "One more time. It's past the bone. Just one more time." Frank told Chuck to get another shot of morphine, and Dean said, "Don't. Shit's half worthless anyway. Just do it quick. If I pass out, good." Frank stood there for a moment, and he looked at Dean and at the rest of them, and then he nodded and said, "All right." He got up on the table this time so that he could brace Dean's leg with his knee and use both of his hands on the arrow. Dean lay there with the black shaft sticking out of him, and he was horribly white, and tears were running from under his eyelids, and Cass said, "Wait." "Wait," Frank said. "Wait what?" Cass sat down. He said, "Dean." And Dean opened his eyes and looked at him. When Castiel found Dean in hell, he had looked nothing like himself, but his eyes had been the same. So that every time after that Cass had looked at Dean, he saw the soul he'd pulled from hell, but now within the man he knew on earth, and later, much later, he would understand that this had been the beginning of his long fall and the becoming of what he was now. No one had prepared him for it. No one could have. Dean said, "Castiel?" Castiel smiled and said, "That's right." And he put his hand on Dean's forehead. "What?" "Shh," he said. "Something must remain." He sat there with his eyes closed and his hand on Dean's forehead. Once he could have put him out, or healed him, or taken him away from here. But now he could only do this, and he wasn't even sure it would work until he felt Dean relaxing under his hand. He opened his eyes, and Dean was gazing at him calmly, and smiled at him in a way he hadn't done in years, and it pierced Castiel's heart. Castiel looked at Frank and said, "Do it now." Frank just stared at him, and Castiel said, "Go ahead." And Frank bent over and pushed the arrow through, and Dean twitched and grabbed Castiel's wrist, and Castiel said, "It's all right." Frank broke the arrowhead off and threw it on the floor, and then the shaft came out with a sucking pop. The entry wound was perfectly round and smooth-edged, but the exit wound was ragged and torn, and dark rills of blood flowed from both like taps. They turned Dean onto his back and eased his leg up, and Tricia put compresses on both wounds, and Dean didn't say a word and lay there staring at Castiel. "What is that?" Frank said. "Some kind of hypnosis?" Dean murmured, "He's an angel." "Was," Castiel said quietly. "Once. My guardian angel." "What did he say?" "Nothing." Dean raised his head and looked down at himself. "Fuck," he said. "My ass looked great in those jeans." Tricia laughed in surprise, and so did Frank, because they had never heard him joke like that before, or hardly joke at all about anything. And then Dean said, "Get me my phone. I need to call Sam." They stopped laughing and looked at each other. "Come on, I have to call him. Get me my phone." Castiel said, "Dean, get me my..." He looked at the holster on his other leg, and he started pulling at the straps. "What the fuck is this? I need my phone. Get me my..." "Dean," Castiel said, "you need to get some sleep." "What?" He touched the tips of his fingers to Dean's forehead. "Go to sleep now," he said, and Dean's eyes fluttered for a moment, and then he was out. They cleaned the wounds and bandaged them, and they unbuckled Dean from all of his weapons and hardware and picked him up off the table and took him to his cabin. Castiel stayed behind, and after a while he put his sweater back on and began to clean Dean's blood off the table. In the early morning hours, long before dawn, Castiel sat up beside Dean in the cold cabin, with no light except for the oil lantern, and no heat except for a barrel stove with old newspapers and a few damp sticks smoldering inside. In his hands he turned over the broken arrow that Frank had pulled out of Dean's leg. It was crudely handmade, the broadhead hammered from some piece of metal, and Castiel didn't know if the weapons out there were really so depleted, or if the infected had begun pounding out their own devices in their mindless rage, beating plowshares into swords. He put the pieces of the arrow aside and raised the blankets to look at Dean's leg. It was propped on a rolled sleeping bag to ease the swelling, but it was bleeding freely, and the bandage was dark red on the front of Dean's thigh and the back, and Castiel began to unwrap it so that he could apply a compress. He heard the door open, and Tricia came in with a damp chill and a gust of dead leaves behind her, and she closed the door and stood there hugging her elbows. "How is he?" she whispered. Castiel shrugged. "Bloody. Is he awake?" "No, he hasn't woken up yet." She looked down at Dean and then at Castiel. "That was amazing, what you did." Castiel smiled. "It was just the morphine kicking in," he said, and he coiled the sodden bandage on the floor and took up two pieces of cloth and pressed them to the wounds. Dean moaned and turned his head, but he didn't wake up. "Do you need some help?" she asked, and Castiel shook his head. She sat down cross-legged on the floor beside him and looked at what he was doing and began soaking clean cloths in disinfectant. Neither of them spoke. Castiel knew that she had been sleeping with Dean for about a week, and he supposed that she might love him, or think she loved him, or want to believe that love still existed, and so she was here. After a while, he asked, "How was the mission?" "Bad," she said. "We can't stay here. There's barely anything left to scavenge, and there were troops in the city rounding people up. Infected, uninfected, same as the other places. If they find us here, they'll take us to one of those places and torch us like the others." "They won't find us." "We've got a problem if Dean's out of commission." "You don't think our fearless leader will be up and around tomorrow? Oh, ye of little faith." "He should take it easy. Let someone else carry the load for a while." "He won't. He can't." "I know." Castiel put down the soiled compresses, and she handed him a fresh pair. Outside, the rain had started up again, and the wind blew under the log eaves and hooted around the doors and windows, and it was very cold. Tricia shivered. "You should go to bed," Castiel said. "There's not much to do here." "I couldn't sleep." She sat beside him quietly, and after a moment she said, "You've known him for a long time, haven't you?" "No, 6 years. It feels like more, but it's only 6 years. He was wrapping the bandage around Dean's leg, and he could feel Tricia staring at him, and he didn't say anything. Then she said, "Are you gay?" Castiel smiled. He shook his head. "I'm not gay." "Then what's with the two of you? I'm sorry, I know it's none of my business, but that scene back in the kitchen? I don't know what you did, but I feel like you couldn't have done that for just any of us. And he puts up with shit from you that he wouldn't from anyone else, and the way you look at him sometimes." Castiel kept on wrapping the bandage, checking for tension. "How do I look at him?" "I don't know," she said, and then went on. "Like he's the only thing left that matters, and you hate him for it, or you hate yourself for thinking it." Castiel fastened the bandage with clips. He eased Dean's leg down and covered him up. He looked at his hands. They were bloody, and he picked up one of the cloths and started to clean them, and he smiled but didn't look up. "Patricia," he said, "that's your full name, isn't it?" "Yes." "I had a full name too once. Castiel, the name my father gave me. When I met Dean, I was still Castiel." She didn't say anything, and he raised his head and looked at her sitting beside him in the dim lamplight and the darkness of the cabin behind her, with the smell of blood and alcohol in the air. Another one of God's abandoned children. Like Dean. Like himself. "He was in prison and I was sent to get him out. That was my job. There were conditions applied to that parole. It was also my job to ensure that Dean fulfilled those conditions. I was committed to my work. I was faithful. But then something happened, and I couldn't do what I was sworn to do. He smiled. I lost faith in my employers. I couldn't give him over to them. But he shook his head. That's not the truth. The truth is that I couldn't give him over. He fell silent. You knew him before he lost his brother?
Yes.
He never talks about him. Tonight was the first time I ever heard him say his name.
I know.
Is his brother really dead?
He is lost, yes.
What was he like before?
Castiel thought about this. He might have said that Dean was foul-mouthed and funny and hedonistic, and that he was arrogant and impulsive and foolish, and he was compassionate and noble and fearless. He was broken, and yet he endured, hard and yet soft, and he had loved his brother too much, and yet not wisely enough, and that he was so painfully, terribly human, that when the angels asked Castiel to come with them and away from this place forever, he'd had no choice but to refuse, and he could have said any of this to this woman beside him, but he didn't. He was surprising. She was quiet, and then softly she said, "Oh." Castiel didn't look at her, and after a moment she put her hand on his knee, and when he raised his eyes she was smiling, and she said, "Well, you're only human." He almost laughed. She didn't say anything else. The oil lamp hissed and smoked. After a while, she said that she needed to get some sleep, and she stood up and said good night and went out into the rain. In the morning, just before daybreak, Castiel left the cabin and stood outside the door and rubbed his neck. The light of that early hour was not gray as it should have been, but coppery and dull, and in the east through the trees he could see the dawn ascending as a red streak against the land that lay still in darkness. The night's rain had stopped, but the eaves in the trees were dripping, and the sound of it was all around him like hushed footsteps, and the scent of wet earth and pine woods was pleasant, and yet couldn't mask the faintly rotten smell of the camp itself. Moldering cabins and sullen fires and makeshift stoves and garbage left behind by God knew how many refugees who had sought shelter in this place. He stood there and looked out at the camp and into the woods. His breath steamed softly in the chill air. The encroaching day came on hesitantly and without birdsong, as if aware of its own predestined mortality, and then some small bird in the woods called out with one note and another answered, and Castiel listened to them for a moment, and then he turned and went back inside. Dean was propped on his elbows with the blankets cast off to the side, and he was looking at his leg. It was swollen and bruised and ugly, but the bandage had only a trace of blood on it. He looked up at Castiel. "Guess I'm lucky I didn't get my nuts skewered. How does it feel?" "Like I had a fucking arrow pulled out of it," he said, and he began to struggle onto his feet. Castiel said, "What are you doing?" and crossed the cabin and put his hand on Dean's shoulder. "What the fuck does it look like? I'm getting up." "You shouldn't." Dean shook his head. "We have to get back on the road. This place is screwed." "The rest of us can take care of that." "Yeah," Dean said. "Mm-hmm." He was up on his knees with one hand braced on the floor, and he raised his arm and said, "Give me a hand here." Castiel crouched down and got his shoulder under Dean's arm and hauled him to his feet, and Dean's injured leg buckled, and he hissed in pain and swore. Castiel started to lower him back down to the floor, but Dean tightened his arm around Castiel's neck. "Come on, come on, get me up." Castiel wrapped his arm around Dean's waist and pulled him upright, and Dean groaned, and for a moment the two of them just stood there while Dean caught his breath. Then Dean put some weight on his left leg and took a shuffling step and said, "Okay." They made a clumsy turn around the room, and by the end of it, Dean was sweating and gray in the face, and Castiel sat him down on the ledge under the window. Dean put his head down and closed his eyes and gripped the edge of the seat, and Castiel brought him a cup of water. There was a folding stool beside the stove, and he dragged it over and sat down before Dean and waited for some color to come back in his face. A faint crust of blood was dried onto Dean's forehead, and Castiel reached out and brushed it off. Dean glanced up at him wearily. "Think you could manage another laying on of hands or something?" "I don't know," Castiel said. "I could try." He leaned forward and put his hands on Dean's leg as lightly as he could, but there was nothing there at all.
Whatever he'd been able to do last night had only been an echo of what he'd once been, and now even that was gone. He looked at Dean ruefully and shook his head. "Oh well," Dean said. He sighed and looked around the cabin and said, "I need some pants, Cass. I can't go walking around in my shorts." Cass found him a pair of sweatpants that would fit over the swelling in the bandage, and by the time Dean got them on, he needed to rest again. He wiped his hand over his face and sat there and stared at the floor, and Cass stared at him. He felt so helpless. He felt so grateful. It was a terrible affliction, this humanity. Dean said, "You must hate those sons of bitches." "Who?" "Those fucking angels. The way they just left you here. Never even told you they were leaving." He shook his head. "What a bunch of pricks." Cass smiled. "I don't think about it." Dean stood up with a grimace, and when Cass tried to help him, Dean waved him off. He limped to the door and let himself out and leaned against the porch post. Cass stood in the doorway behind him, and Dean turned his head and looked at him over his shoulder. "Well, I do," he said, "and I'm sorry." He turned away and hobbled down the steps and began to make his way across the camp in the flat red light of the nascent day. Cass watched him go. "I'm not," he said. He stood there for a moment, and then he closed the door behind him and went down the steps and followed Dean. The Shame of It All, set in the future, portrayed in episode 5-4, The End. In the gray and wet evening after they had been driving for 3 days from the smoking ruins of Birmingham, they found the house, set back into that mountainous country and well hidden by the trees so that only one chimney had been visible through the fog, red brick almost of a color with the trees. It was not an old house, but a large one, built to grand size by someone with money and lordly aspirations, and now wholly abandoned. There were 11 people in the group, including Dean and Cass himself, and 4 of them, including Dean, went in first to make sure that the house was secure. When they gave the all clear, the small party emerged from their trucks and climbed the stairs, and for a moment they all stood huddled in the entry hall, stinking in their damp coats and sweaters. From the top of the curving staircase, the last day's light fell upon them through an arched cathedral window, and Cass thought that the house itself must have been outraged by the intrusion of this cold and filthy band of refugees. In observance of the cold nights in these mountains, the builder of the house had installed fireplaces in many of the rooms, and these were no decorative accents with polite gas jet, but great brick hearths for burning wood. It was a house built as if for some earlier century and not an age of central heating and electricity, or perhaps in premonition of some disaster to come. The builder was not there to explain or know the perfection of his design. There was a dry woodshed attached to the house and at least a whole cord of seasoned wood inside. They filled the kitchen fireplace with logs and kindling and set them on fire, and Frank took the bellows from the iron stand and fanned the flames into a blaze. They stood there and stared at it, all of them, even Dean. Around them, the fittings of a rich man's kitchen stood useless in the firelight. The pendant lights with their glass shades, the brushed pewter faucets, the monstrous Viking stove. Of these things, only fire remained. They ate in a semicircle around the fire, and then some of them just lay down on the floor and fell asleep. Dean wiped his mouth and stood up with his rifle and said that he was going to see what else there was to the place. Everyone who was still awake looked too tired or too warm to move, and Dean raised an eyebrow at Cass, and Cass got up and went with him. They found a well-stocked pantry, and Cass watched Dean sizing up and mentally cataloging the stores. "All of this goes with us," he said, and Cass nodded. Dean opened one of the coffin freezers, and a stench of rotting meat belched out, and he slammed it shut. "That's a fucking waste." They went outside and stood on the back porch, and Dean swept his flashlight through the darkness. "What the fuck is that?" he said, and before Cass could answer, Dean was down the steps and across the field. Cass followed him. A few yards from the house, they came to what Dean had picked up in his flashlight, and Dean said, "Holy shit." It was a cast-iron water pump set upon a concrete platform, the handle elaborately wrought and untouched by rust, with an iron bucket of similar design at its feet, full of rainwater. Do you think it works? Cass said. One way to find out. Grab that bucket and prime it. What? The bucket. You have to prime the pump to get it going. Cass stared at him, and Dean put his rifle down and handed him the flashlight and said, Here, you pump this thing and I'll prime it. Dean raised the bucket and poured water on the spout and said, Start pumping it. Nothing happened, and Dean held off and then poured some more water and did it again, and then suddenly water burst from the pump with a gurgling rush, and Dean actually laughed. Cass couldn't remember the last time he'd seen Dean laugh that way. Dean set down the bucket and put his hand under the pump and raised it to his mouth and drank. Damn, he said. That's cold. Sweet, but cold. He splashed water on his face. Everyone's going to be real happy when they see this. He straightened up and dried his hands on his jacket. Cass stopped pumping, and the flow of water eased off to a trickle, and he collected some in his hands and drank, and the water was sweet, just as Dean had said. The trickle became a drip and then stopped. They stood there and stared at the pump, spellbound. Then Dean said, Well, I know what I'm going to do. There was a smaller room on the first floor, like a den or private study, and it also had its own fireplace, and Dean built up the fire in there and set the iron bucket of water in the flames and then left. Cass sat there by himself. He looked at his hands on his knees. He looked at the bucket and the fire. After a little while, Dean came back with the dish towel slung over his shoulder and carrying a silver punch bowl of bacchanalian proportions. Fucking rich people, he said. How many times do you think they use this thing? Cass didn't answer. He sat there and watched Dean, and Dean took a lamp off a side table and set the bowl down on it and leaned over the fire and stirred the water with his hand, and Cass stood up and crossed to the door. When he was at the door, Dean said, Hey, Cass, could you bring some more wood? Cass turned and looked over his shoulder. Dean had the dish towel around the handle of the bucket and was pouring water into the bowl. He said, What? Wood, Dean said. Can you bring some more wood? I don't want this thing going out. It's still fucking freezing in here. Cass stared at him. Dean had emptied the bucket, and he set it down on the hearthstone and turned back to Cass and shrugged off his jacket and started unbuttoning his shirt, and he paused with his hands on the third button and looked at Cass and said, Wood? Right, Cass said. And he turned and opened the door and let himself out into the cold hallway and closed the door behind him. He made his way through the dark house. At the foot of the stairs, he paused and put his hand on the rail and stood there. The sky had cleared, and a pale half-moon shone through the cathedral window. When Cass, Castiel once, had been an angel, Dean had kept up a quaint and almost amusing modesty around him, the way a woman of a certain age or place would keep her hat on in a church. In those days, Dean would eat or swear or belch or make appalling observations in front of Castiel, not only with no reserve, but often with a sort of child's delight in offending. But he wouldn't take off his clothes in front of Castiel. And if Castiel was in a motel room with Dean, and Dean was showering, he would come out of the bathroom already dried and dressed, as if some vague and fusty notion of pious respect advised him to act that way. In those days... Cass went into the kitchen and stepped softly around the sleeping bodies and took half a dozen logs from the woodshed and went back to the study. When he opened the door, Dean was standing before the fire naked, artlessly scrubbing his armpit with the towel. Cass stood there. Shut the door, you're letting all the heat out. He kicked the door shut and crossed the room and put the wood down by the fire. He turned and looked up at Dean. Dean was washing the back of his neck, and he was standing in profile. And Cass could see the way the light lay smoothly on Dean's cheek and jaw, and his skin was rosy from it, and it was a long time since Cass had seen him so clean-shaven. His eyes were closed, and he said, Christ, that feels good, and Cass got up and turned to go. Dean said, You got an appointment somewhere? I was going to go back in the kitchen. Well, it's warmer in here. Sit down. I need to talk to you. Cass sat down on the leather couch. He folded his hands in his lap. He stared at the fire, and Dean talked about the house, how long they could stay there, what might be in the surrounding hills, how much they could take with them when they left. Cass sat there and listened, but didn't listen. After a while, he let his eyes drift toward Dean. Dean wasn't looking at him. He was talking and washing and not looking at him. He put the towel in the water and picked it up and wrung it out, and the water drops were like falling rubies in the firelight. He bent over and began washing himself between his legs as briskly and gracelessly as he would rub down a dog or a horse. He was quiet now and gazing at the opposite wall, preoccupied with something and not focused on what he was doing, and Cass watched him scrub thoughtlessly at the creases between his thigh and groin and the insides of his legs. Once he would have thought little of seeing Dean naked. He had pulled Dean up out of hell and had seen him stripped of far more than clothing, and the naked body had been nothing but flesh to him, but once was not now. Since Castiel had fallen from grace, and since he had become human, he had been with 27 women and 2 men. The women had been Lori or Amy or Karen or Rachel, but both of the men had been Dean to him, or he had wanted them to be Dean. He loved Dean in the way that Dean let himself be loved, and Cass had never laid a desiring hand on him. Yet if Dean had ever shown any sign of wanting that from him, Cass would have given him anything he asked. But he hadn't. Hence the men, who had been neither one of them Dean, and so there had only been 2 and no more. Dean stood in a slight stoop with his back to the fire, and the light played on the curve of his waist and the crest of his hip, softly dimpled with goose flesh, the small of his back in the firelight too, the bones of his spine that cast a shadow on his skin, a few drops of water between his shoulder blades, glittering in the fire, dark shadows between his legs. He straightened up and put the towel in the bowl and swirled it around. The light fell on the side of his face and his cheekbones and downcast eyelashes. Cass would have done anything, anything to touch him, kiss him, lie down naked with him, anything. He stood up and said, "I'm going out for a smoke," and Dean said he could smoke in there, but he was already out the door and had closed the door behind him and stumbled through the entry hall and let himself out on the porch. He went down the steps and out a ways from the house and put his back against a tree and shoved his hands down his jeans, and that wasn't enough, so he unfastened them and got himself in hand and took care of himself with a few quick strokes, his breath catching in his throat and biting his lip to keep from crying out. He came and heard it fall on the leaves at his feet. Something that still amazed him, the shocking release and euphoria, and shame, too. He leaned his head against the tree and caught his breath. He looked up at the moon through the branches, and the air was cold on his face and his hands on his cock. His legs shook. After a moment, he tucked himself back in and fastened his jeans. He crouched down and wiped his hand on the dead grass. Then he did light a cigarette. He sat down. He smoked. When he went back inside, Dean was dressed, and he glanced up at Cass and said, "Good smoke?" "Always." "You should cut that shit out. I don't think there are too many oncologists left. Assuming I'll live long enough to get cancer. Yeah, that is unlikely, Dean said. He picked up the bowl and carried it to the window, then opened the window and pitched the water out onto the lawn. He closed the window and put the bowl back on the table, and then spread the towel out on the bucket before the fire to dry. He gestured at the bowl. You want to wash up? Maybe tomorrow. Suit yourself. He stood up and stretched his back. I'm going to sleep in a real bed tonight, he said. You staying up, or you want me to take first watch? I'll stay up, Cass said. I'm wide awake. Well, wake me when you're ready. Okay. Dean left, and Cass sat down. The fire was down to coals. He heard Dean collecting logs from the woodshed at the other end of the house, and then going up the stairs. Dean's footsteps softly crossed the floor above him and then stopped. It was so quiet he could hear the faint creak of the bed when Dean lay down. Then silence, a whisper of ashes in the grate. He got up and went to the fire and picked up the towel. It was almost dry, and he stood there and looked at it. After a while, he folded it and put it in his pocket, and then went out for the first watch of the night. This is Baylor, and you've been listening to Keep Thee in All Thy Ways, an anthology of supernatural fic by Ossell. You can find these and Ossell's other works at OSELLE.livejournal.com. Thanks for listening.